We're in the fifth chapter of Isaiah, and I want to cover about a couple of chapters tonight. Now, in this fifth chapter, it divides itself into three parts. First of all, the first five verses, the seven verses rather, deal with God's vineyard. Now, keep in mind that we're about 100 years, a little over 100 years earlier than Ezekiel. We're back during the Assyrian period, when Assyria was threatening Judah. And God called Isaiah to prophesy to the people, warning them against such a condition that they'd be carried away, and he succeeded. Isaiah's preaching, and Micah, who was a village preacher nearby, around about in the country, along with a couple of three good kings that they had, were able to stall off the captivity of the Assyrians. Didn't come until we come to Babylon. I'm beginning with verse 1. Let me see. Now, this is the first two verses Isaiah is speaking. This is a poem or a song. Let me sing for my well-beloved, a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. Now, the beloved was Jehovah. Jehovah the beloved, and it's his vineyard of which he is singing. My well-beloved had a vineyard in a very fruitful hill, and he digged it and gathered out the stones thereof, and planted it with the choicest vine, and built a tower in the midst of it, and also hewed out a wine press therein, and it looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. Now, the picture then is this. The hills of Palestine are exceedingly rocky. I also have been in rocks in my life, and I did in that part of the country. Of course, the water, during the 3,000 years since they went and took the land, well, of course, the rain washed away a great deal of it. They didn't terrace it like they should. But you imagine Jehovah now. Here's a hill, and he digs out all the rocks, and builds a hedge around it, plants his vineyard in the midst of it. Then he took also the rocks and built a tower from which to watch and to observe and to act as a guard of his people. He was all of that. So he would naturally expect a harvest. But when he came, instead of finding a harvest in his vineyard, he found only sour grapes. He found a condition fitted for destruction. All right, now the prophet was speaking in those two verses. Now Jehovah speaks. And now all inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. Now you're going to be the judge now of what I should do with it. Now remember, if a man digs out the rocks and plants the vineyard and guards it, if he doesn't find any grapes, he wants to tear it down, that's his business. He can destroy it if he wants to, and that's what God said I'm going to do here. Well, I came to my vineyard. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes? Yeah, exceedingly. So, what does a man have a right to expect when he goes to all that work? A good crop of grapes. And, of course, the nation's what he's talking about here. It's an allegory of the nation. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. Now, this he has a right to do this. It's his. He planted, dug the rocks out, all that. So if he wants to tear it down, destroy it, he can do that. That's his business. Now, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. Now, there are about three things here. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. That is, it's going to be burnt up or destroyed. The idea. So if you take away the hedge, and those are a hedge of thorny growths there to keep out the wild animals, and God had built a hedge about his people to keep out the foreigners, to keep out the heathen people from destroying it. All right, now second, I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. I'll break down the wall, I'll break down the hedge that I put about, I'll remove that. Now third, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor hoed, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that there rain no rain upon it. Well, of course, it's an allegory. But God, in that, claims to control the clouds as well as everything else. And he does that. I don't always know when God's holding back and send a drought to some purpose or when he sends a flood. I don't try to say it that he's doing it. I don't know. I know it has in the past. I know he may be doing it at that time. And it could be. So I leave that in the realm of something that I'm not sure of. But that's what I'll do when I dig down, I tear down the hedge, and I'll not let it rain upon it. I'll break down the walls, and I'll just cover it again with stone, let the grass come up, and it'll be waste there. All right? And no rain upon it. For the vineyard of Jehovah of hosts is the house of Israel. Now, I explained what he's talking about. Here's the explanation of this parable. For the vineyard of Jehovah of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And they look for justice, but oppression, for righteousness, and behold a cry. Now, in that, there's a play on words that we miss in the translation into English. Now, that first word there, I look for justice, which is mishpat. I said I found oppression, which is mishpat. I looked for mishpat, but I found mishpah in the language there, for righteousness, which is sedeka, and behold a cry, seka. So they looked for sedeka, but he found seka. So to them is a play on word that could be translated. So we get the idea there of justice and oppression, righteousness, and behold a cry. Cry there upon the people in that. But in the original Hebrew, while those four words there make a play on words there. Well, all right. Now, there he explains what the vineyard is. It's the nation and the people there in it, and the city and all that, just the whole nation of people there. Now comes the judgment, the harvest, rather. Here's the harvest. Now, when he looked for grapes, he found only wild grapes. Here's what he found. Now, here he got six wolves in the rest of this chapter. Now, I want to notice these very particularly. Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no room, and you be made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. Now here were the wealthy. They were getting the land, and they were driving the people out of the country and out of their inheritance into the city. And here were these little houses joined up one to the other there, kind of a run-down situation there. This is what he finds. In mine ears, said Jehovah of hosts, of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. Now, these great houses that you're building, out in the midst of you're getting the fields, you're getting all the land, you're getting that under your control, driving the people out. Now then, after a while, those houses that you're building will be without inhabitant. That's the first rule here. It's war against the greedy, against those that want to get everything under their control and take it away from others. I'd be without inhabitant, for 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, that's just a few gallons, and a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. In other words, a bushel of grain will yield only a peck of grain. And here the vineyard here, instead of 10 acres here, instead of a bountiful harvest, why you just have one big jar, is all you'll have. So that's the first. So you greedy ones, this is going to come upon you. And here's a second rule. Woe unto them that rise up early in the morning, that they may follow strong drink, that tarry late into the night, till wine inflame them, and the harp, and the lute, and the tabret, and the pipe, and wine are in their feasts, but they regard not the work of Jehovah, neither have they considered the oppression, the operation of my hands. Right now, instead of the people following after good industry there, why they begin drinking in the morning, and they have their rock concerts there. I guess that's about what they were then. You'll notice there when they have the harp and the lute and the tabret and the pipe and wine, and it reminds us of today when this country is a drinking country, and it's got all of these rock concerts and all of that, and I despise the things. You turn on your television here and here, they've got those gyrating rock guys there. And we're following the same pattern as they followed back there. God pleased with it? No. No, we're concerned with and now you can add drugs to it and narcotics to it today. You've got all of that. Drinking and narcotics and drugs and your wild music and all that sort of thing. Every bit of it is of the devil. Every bit of it reflects the very image of the devil. Leave God out, and you're going to bring this country to destruction. It brought them to destruction, and it won't be any different with us. And so let's try to see in this study how God handles situations such as these and exist today. This to me is the practical point. We know what's going on. How long can it last? Only God knows. But what's going to be the end of it? Judgment. Judgment will be the end. That's on its way. All right, now he moves on. Now that's the second move. That's the second move. Now, therefore, my people. Now notice your therefores. Now because therefore, my people are gone into captivity for lack of knowledge. Now back in Hosea 4 and 6, God says, for lack of knowledge, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And that lack of the knowledge of God destroys any people. And in this country, God is practically ruled out. We all understand that. We know that. I was talking to a couple from the big Palo Verde church today. He's one of the elders. Talking to them about situations. Talking about their lack of enthusiasm, lack of interest. Well, it's that way most everywhere. Most everywhere. People are too concerned about other things. Where's your first therefore? Therefore, they say they're gone. They hadn't gone into captivity yet. They were in captivity to their sins. They were not in captivity to a foreign country yet. But they were in captivity to their lusts, to their desires. But they're going into captivity for lack of knowledge. For their honorable men are famished, and their multitude are parched with thirst. Now, while they're drunk on wine, they're starving with hunger and thirst for the knowledge of God. So that's what we're doing today. We're in the midst of a great famine of the Word of God in this country. But we've got plenty of the material things. But that'll be taken away one day. Here's another therefore. Therefore Sheol hath enlarged its desire and opened its mouth without measure. And their glory and their multitude and their pomp and he that rejoiceth among them descend into it. Now Sheol is the realm of the unseen, the realm of the dead. Now here is Sheol as a great yawning opening here, and people are going into it here, swallowing them up. Right? And so the wicked shall be turned back into Sheol, even all the nations that forget God. Psalm 9:17. Well, that principle, you see, is pointed out here. And so I've said it so many times, you may be tired of it, that we're headed for a judgment. In my mind, there's no question about it. From whence it will come, when it will come, what the nature of it will be, I don't know. Will it be a war, an atomic war? Will it be floods and drought that destroy our substance over here? What will it be? I don't know. Will it be an internal war? Will it be a civil war within? We've got a lot of folks that like to start one over here. I'm hoping it won't be that, but I don't know what it'll be, but I know it'll come. Now he goes on to say, and the mean man, that's the lower, the mean man shall be bowed down, and the great man is humbled, and the eyes of the lofty are humbled. Now that's whether it's a lower individual or a great, they're all going to be humbled. They're going to be brought down. But Jehovah of hosts is exalted in justice, and God the Holy One is sanctified in righteousness. Now, as you read this book, observe that justice and righteousness are constantly used together, as they are here. And God is sanctified in justice and righteousness and holiness. In other words, what he does will magnify his own holiness as over against that kind of condition, and his righteousness in the judgment. Then shall the lamb's feed is in that pasture, and the waste places of the fat ones shall wanderers eat. In other words, when the people are driven out, when they're carried into captivity, and you who have got greedy, who have gotten all this land, you'll be driven out of it. And the lambs will just wander around here and yonder, and they'll belong to anybody that wants to live on it. The wanderers to eat there, the sojourners, so they pass through. All right, now there are two of his woes. The first one is the greedy, and those greedy ones then are those then who spend their time in drinking and in feasting, and in their musical concerts and all that sort of thing. Lascivious, the whole thing is a picture of lasciviousness and those things. Why, here's the judgment that's coming to them. Now here's the third woe. Woe unto them that draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, and sin as it were with a cart rope, that say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel, that's in irony, because that's the word that Isaiah uses. The Holy One of Israel draw nigh and come, that we may know it. That's the response of these drinkers. Here, these are revelers. Let him do it. But now he says, but woe to them that draw iniquity with a cart rope. In other words, here's a cart. It's packed up. Now here's a fellow dragging that along with a rope here. Well, now they were dragging iniquity. They were dragging it along with them. And it's going to overtake them and destroy them. That's the picture of it that he shows there. And but now they're ridiculing. Well, let God make speed. Let him do what he said he's going to do, that we may see it. They've got no faith in God. Fourth rule. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil. That put darkness for light and light for darkness. That put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. In other words, they reached a point to where they couldn't distinguish between the sweet and the bitter, the good and the bad. Now that's the way the Pharisees had reached that point when they couldn't tell it. We said Sunday morning when we dealt with that passage in Luke there. Well, you have this same condition back on it. Well, I think that our nation is doing that today. They're putting evil for good and good for evil, and darkness for light, light for darkness, sweet for bitter and bitter for sweet. They don't know the difference. And what they are teaching and what's being done by the wicked of this country shows that they're looking for something and finding nothing. They don't know what to look for. That's a condition back there. All right. Here's another woe. I believe that's the third one. And this is the fourth. The fifth, one or the other, whatever it is, one, two, three, four, yeah, this is the fifth one. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight, who magnify their own wisdom. Woe unto them. You ever listen to some of those eggheads from the university there on a newscast down there and try to tell you how smart they are and all that about some of these things? They can tell they're ignorant of a herd of cattle. They're philosophers. They're psychologists and sociologists, all that. They don't know principles. They don't know the divine things of God. And they sit up there and they're so smart, and you're trying to impress you how smart they are. Some of them are smart. Some ways, pretty ignorant others. And today, trying to determine the destiny, what all is going to be, and how to do to handle things and all that. And handling all the drug deals and the homosexuality and all that sort of thing. They never acknowledge anything as wrong. You ever notice that? The moral issue never comes up. They never discuss a thing from the moral point of view. It's always from a sociological or philosophical or some other kind of ological type of thing, whatever it might be. All right? Well, that's the way the world back then. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight, who think they are smart. And they just don't know which way we're going. We don't today. We've got some men in Washington. I think they're some of them smart. And I think they're trying to figure the thing out. But they aren't. They aren't figuring it out. They just exchange the truth of God for lies. They just can't read it. On here, the sixth woe. Woe unto them that are mighty to drink wine, and men of strength to mingle strong drink, that justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the righteousness of the righteous from him. Now here's some fellows. Their only claim to fame is that they're good bartenders. They don't like to mix drinks. Watch your television. You have a drink and here they go in the mix. Every time anybody comes in the house, they don't fix you a drink. They're all drinking there. I'd like to notice two of these woes involve drinking. Well, read the newspaper, listen to the radio, television news. How many of our collision, our car wrecks and those things, how many of them are alcohol related? Was it 40% or 60%? One or the other, 60? I think it's 60. I know it's a high percentage of them are alcohol related. And they're trying to do something about it, except stop them from making and selling the stuff. Right, but at any rate, they're strong to mingle strong drinks. That's the strength of it. Now to justify the wicked for bribe, take away the righteousness of the righteous from him. No justice. Now, over the television, this one witness that they had in this, what's her name? Little Vicky. Yeah. All right. You know, Little Vicky. The one witness, they fooled him until he died with cancer. What did they finally do? They finally throw that out. They keep putting it off, fighting to try the guy within the first 6 weeks, and if guilty, put him in the chair and turn on the juice, and if he wasn't, turn him loose. One or the other. Why keep him on the expense here of the state here? Now this fellow's dead, and no witness. Now they fool around after a while, they just throw the case out. No witness there. This is the thing that irritated. Now, this is what God was dealing with back under. You had the same deal back there. And what did he do? He took control of it himself. That's what I preached the other day on our relationship to the civil government and what the civil government's relationship to us is. The civil government was ordained to execute the criminal and to protect the righteous. Now, when it moves this way, then what happens? God destroys it. All right. Now you come to your judgment. Now, here's the judgment. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devoureth the stubble, and as the dry grass sinketh down in the flame, so their root shall be as rottenness, and their blossom shall go up as dust, because they have rejected the law or the teaching of Jehovah of hosts, and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. He's talking to his people back there. But I want to tell you, all mankind is responsible to God. Now, you've seen the fire burn and watched that big bunch of grass that had just melted down into it, haven't you? And now the sparks are going up. Well, that's what he's saying here. That's what's going to happen to the nation. God's going to destroy it. Here's another therefore. Always underscore your therefores. When you're reading the Bible, you come to a therefore, underscore it. Because you're coming to a conclusion, or that's based on what, or something to follow, based on what went before it. Therefore is the anger of Jehovah kindled against his people, and he has stretched forth his hand against them, and has smitten them, and the mountains tremble. It's such a terrible judgment that it shakes the very mountains there. Of course, that's hyperbole, I'm sure, but maybe the earthquakes will be in the midst of it. And their dead bodies are as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Now, here's the judgment. The judgment that's on its way there is as a fire and an earthquake that destroys. So he's going to destroy the nation. Now it's going to come to us. We've been asking for it. We're entitled to it. And God's going to let us have it. Now, I don't know if it'll be in my day. Kind of glad I'm 83 instead of 38. Well, I don't want to turn that around, because I think that's going to come. It might come before I get through. All right, now, the judgment continues. And he will lift up an ensign, that's a flag, from a sign, to the nations from far. I know where the judgment's coming from. And will hiss for them, whistle for them, we'd say, for them from the end of the earth, and behold, they shall come with speed swiftly. And when you come over to the 10th chapter, and here he calls for Assyrians, yet the Assyrian didn't know he was being used. God said, "Lo, I raise up those people." Right? They shall come with speed and swiftly. None shall be weary nor stumble among them. None shall slumber nor sleep. Neither shall the girdle of their loins be loosed, nor the latchet of their shoes be broken. Now that doesn't mean they won't stop and eat, and they won't stop and sleep. What it means is, when I call for them, they're going to come with haste. They're going to come. When God says the time for a judgment has come, that judgment is coming. God said the time has come somehow. Somebody will pull the trigger on one of those atomic bombs, and then somebody else will start throwing them back, and here we'll be. And we're so high in the world that ever gets started. How did that ever happen? Well, I might not be able to give you the details, but I can tell you who's behind it. You say, "God would do that?" Yes, sir. And God said, "I'll call for them. When the time comes that you need a judgment, I'll send it." Now, a lot of folks can't accept that. They say, "Well, God is love." That's right. God said, "I hate every false way." God said, "Lo, I raise up these fellows." Moving on, 28. The latchet of whose shoes shall not be broken, whose arrows are sharp, and all their bows bent. Their horses' hoofs shall be accounted as flint, and their wheels are the whirlwind. In other words, you see an advancing army coming with speed to execute God's will in this judgment. Their roaring shall be like a lion's. They shall roar like young lions. Yea, they shall roar and lay hold of the prey and carry it away safe, and there shall be none to deliver. When God is not there to deliver, there'll be none to deliver. God controls in these matters. And I'm glad I've lived long enough to study the Bible enough to know that, to believe that. Therefore, can say it's all in His hand. So when it comes, it'll be a righteous judgment because it'll be from God. Everything He does is just and righteous because it was and from His point of view. And some of us, some of the Christians may suffer with it, but that's all right. They've got something better. And they shall roar against them in all in that day like the roaring of the sea. And if one look under the land, behold darkness and distress, and the light is darkened in the clouds thereof. Now those first five chapters, I'm going to get this next one right quickly. Those first five chapters really introduce the book. They set forth in the first chapter here a condition, but God calls to come, let us reason together. Second chapter, He shows what's going to be in the distant future. Comes back to the immediate situation, and then points out the church, the remnant redeemed. Right now, then He returns here to show the condition of the people that it was God's vineyard, God planted it, the condition of that vineyard, and His judgment against it. It's His, and if He wants to destroy it, He has a perfect right to do that, because it was His. He redeemed those people and brought them there. Now, as to why Isaiah waited under the sixth chapter to introduce himself, his call, I don't know. I read a lot of commentaries. Every one of them ventures a guess. I don't venture a guess because I don't know. I'd guess, unless I were guessing, I'd say he wants to get this other in here to show the basis of the call. God called Isaiah because there's a condition that God wants to warn the people against. But he could have done that at the first. So why the call of Isaiah comes here instead of at the first of the book, I have to confess I don't know. And I've read lots of commentaries. They make guesses, and they notice me to guess because I get this to the guess. All right, so now we come to the call of Isaiah. Isaiah's call here be a prophet. All right, now first of all is Isaiah's vision of Jehovah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and His train filled the temple. Above Him stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two He covered His feet, a face, and with two He covered His feet, and with two He did fly. One cried unto another and said, Holy, 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 is Jehovah of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. The foundation of the threshold shook at the voice of Him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, woe is me. Now that's your seventh woe. Now Isaiah, woe is me. I come back to that in a moment. Now let's look at this. Uzziah died about 740. So it was about that year that Isaiah, Uzziah was a great king. He was one of their best kings, one of the four or five best kings they had. Now, evidently, Isaiah had a great admiration for him. He looked unto him. Now when he died, he lifted up his eyes now and saw Jehovah. He realizes that it isn't lost because you've lost a good king. God still rules. So he lifted up his eyes and saw Jehovah, the Lord, sitting upon the throne high and lifted up. Don't you know that was a majestic vision? Where was he when he saw it? I don't know. Most likely he was in the temple. No doubt he was in the temple worshiping. I like to think of him here in the temple worshiping, and all at once, why, the whole temple just evaporates. And looks beyond in this vision, and he sees God upon His throne, high and lifted up. Notice first, and His train, that is His garments, filled the temple. The whole floor was filled with a train, that is His garments there, His robes. And above Him stood the seraphim. We're not told how many. There probably a great host of them. Now this is the only place where you have the word seraphim. Seraphim is plural for seraph. Just like cherubim is plural for cherub. Now Ezekiel saw cherubs, or cherubim, but they're different from these. These have six wings. The cherubim have four wings. These have one face. They have four faces. The cherubim. So it's just a different symbol. I look upon these as some of the highest order of angelic beings. And now the two of the wings that cover their feet, with two that cover their face, and with two that did fly. For they're in the presence of the greatness of God. The point of this is the incomparable greatness of God. He is so great and mighty that even the seraphim covered their faces in His presence. No man has seen God at any time. There's a passage in John 12 and verse 41. I think this in here pretty good. Well, let me read that. John 12, 41. Well, here he says, he quotes this passage that we're going to look at in just a moment. Then he said, "These things said Isaiah, because he saw his glory, and he spake to another and said, Holy, 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 the Lord God Almighty, who was and who is and who is to come." Now, they don't quote this, but they say the same three tri-holies, which indicates the perfection of God's holiness, perfect in all of his attributes. They were holy, 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 and the whole earth is full of his glory. And notice the foundation of the threshold shook at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. Now, I don't know the source, whether that's the smoke of incense, or the smoke of his wrath, or just what that might be. We have a case of what we hear, not as a Hebrew writer, who's the effulgence of his glory, and the very image of his substance. So it's when I come into the presence of God, and into the presence of Christ, absolute in holiness, and I become conscious of my own sinfulness. Now, if a fellow lives away from the Lord and separated from him, no, he didn't realize it. Oh, I'm a pretty good Joe. Nothing wrong with me. I'm all right. But when he really looks at himself in the mirror of Christ, he sees himself as he is. And I think that's what preaching ought to do. That's what the Lord's Supper ought to do. That ought to bring us into his presence, to where we measure ourselves not by ourselves, but by him. And that's what Isaiah did. All right, now notice then. "Then flew one of the seraphim unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar." Now, he took this live coal off the altar, part of the altar of incense. Well, that was the altar that was in the, just before the presence of God. Now, he took a live coal with a tongs, but he said he had it in his hand. Did he bring it in tongs, or did he put it in his hand? We're not told. It's immaterial. Just one of those curiosity questions, because we don't know. At any rate, "And he touched my mouth with it, and said, Lo, this hath touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin forgiven." Now, it was neither the seraph, nor was the coal, but it was God that forgave him. Now, I think all of this looks unto the coming of Christ. I want to read the passage in just a moment in John. "And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" You see, we've already had the condition back in the first five chapters. Now, who is going to carry my message to a people in that condition? "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me." He's ready now. He knows the condition. He sees the condition. He sees the absolute holiness of God. Now then, he recognizes his own unworthiness. Now he's touched with a coal. He's cleansed by God. Now then, who goes? "Here am I, send me." And he said, now go. Now notice what God says. He said, "Go and tell this people." He doesn't call them my people. This people, because of their condition. "Go tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not. And see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat. Make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, lest they should and hear with their ears, and turn again and be healed." Now, does that mean that God doesn't want them to be healed, that God's going to do all that? No. No, you remember back in 1:18, "Come, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow, though they be red like crimson. They shall be like wool." No, God wants them, but God knows that the message that ought to turn them to him is going to fall on hard hearts, deaf ears, blind eyes. Now turn over to John. And this passage is quoted in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, and Romans. That passage from Isaiah. Now let's notice here in John, in verse 39-40. "They could not believe, for that Isaiah said again, He had blinded their eyes, and he hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes, and perceive with their heart, and should turn, and I should heal them. Now these things said Isaiah, because he saw his glory, and he spake of him. Nevertheless, even of the rulers, men had believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, he would not believe it." So who was Isaiah talking about back here? He was talking about the one he saw was the Christ, was the one that would become flesh, rather. It was the Lord. He calls him the Lord there. Right? And so Isaiah saw not only what was going to happen, God told him, not only what would happen to your preaching, Isaiah, but this is what's going to happen to the people when I send my servant. We're going to come to him a little bit later. All right, so that the priesthood, now that raises this question. Because preaching goes to one of two things. But most every time that I have observed, God doesn't answer. Here he does. The how long is in the Lord's hand. But God answers this, and I know how long. And he answered, until cities be laid waste without inhabitant, and houses without man, and the land become utterly waste. And Jehovah have removed men far away, and the forsaken places be many in the midst of the land. Well, that's the answer, how long? You just keep preaching, Isaiah. You preach until the land is desolate, the cities are in ruins, and the people are carried away into captivity. I used to tell students in school when I was teaching boys who were preparing to preach, you're going to raise that question, you said, how long shall I preach? Shall I give up? Shall I quit? I turn to this passage. Isaiah asked the same question. How long? There is no place for one to quit. There's no place for that. Keep preaching until the land is ruined, the cities are in shambles, and the people are carried away into captivity. You just preach until there's no more breath in you. That's the answer. And still the answer. So, this is the thing that keeps one continuing on. There's no place to quit. I wish I were reaching more to the people of the community and the people out there that need it, but I'm not. But we're going to preach until it's over. All right? And if there be yet a tenth in it, as a remnant, it also shall in turn be eaten up, as a terebinth, as an oak whose stock remaineth, when they are felled, so the holy seed is the stock thereof. What does that mean? That means that we've already pointed out back in the first chapter and verse 9, when he said, except Jehovah of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we should have been a Sodom and like Gomorrah. Now, there's going to be a remnant left. Yes, you'll be carried into captivity. There'll be a remnant brought back. But now, there's going to be a very small remnant of that remnant that'll be saved. And we had that idea, remember in Ezekiel 5, first four verses, when God told him to take a razor and shave all of the hair off of his head and beard and everything, then divide it into thirds. Burn a third of it, beat a third of it with a sword, throw a third of it to the wind, but out of all it, take a few hairs and sew them in your garment. Then take a few of those hairs and burn them in the fire. Now, those hairs that he burned indicated the small remnant that would be spared, but even of that remnant, only a remnant of that would be left. So Paul said in Romans 11 and 5, even now, there's a remnant according to the election of grace. For that remnant of the Jews that was saved was a very small remnant. And even of the people of God today that obey the gospel, only a remnant of these is going to be saved. Why? Not because God doesn't want to save them, but because of Jesus said, ye would not. People are not interested. Not interested in heaven, not interested in God, not interested in righteousness. It's not just going to heaven. It's the love of that which belongs to God and which is right now, in this life. I told somebody the other day, we were talking about it, I don't know just who it was, about this matter of being a Christian in the world here. If I were, just before I die, if I find out there's nothing to it, that the whole thing, I'm going to be annihilated, that's all there is to it, I'll still say I'm glad I was a Christian, because I got the best out of this life as a Christian, much better than all the people in the world are getting. They think they're getting something, but they're not. So it's not only for the life to come, but of this life. They will want to be a part of that remnant. All right, we'll take chapters about 7 and 8 next time, maybe 9. I'll just go as far as I can, because the book is so long. But we'll take at least 7 and 8, and I may get into the first part of 9. I think I will. All right, well, the class is excused. We had about, how about this? 16 of us tonight. That's good. Good class.